Off the Record is a production of iHeartRadio. Hello and welcome to Off the Record, the show that goes beyond the songs and into the hearts and minds of rock's greatest legends. I'm your host, Jordan Runtog. Thanks so much for listening. Over the last few months, you've joined me as I've explored different eras in the life of David Bowie and talked with key figures from these many periods. But now we're going to do something a little different. From the moment I started this project, I've had friends and loved ones say, "What are you going to do on Labyrinth? You have to do something on Labyrinth." The passion for this movie is immense, and I get it. I was born in 1987, a year after the film was released. I guess that would make me a millennial. Try not to hold it against me. A lot of my friends are the same age, and for us, Labyrinth was our introduction to the man and the mystery that is David Bowie. The style, the swagger, the sass, the pants. First impressions are powerful, especially a first impression like this. To this day, there's a part of me that truly believes that David Bowie really is Jareth the Goblin King. Like so many, Labyrinth was a favorite movie growing up. It was only years later that I discovered it was considered something of a disaster for director Jim Henson, the legendary Lord of the Muppets. It earned just half of its $25 million budget in the States and garnered mixed reviews, many from those who felt it was too mature for children and too fantastical for adults. It was just before Henson's death in 1990 that the film began to enjoy new life on home video. Since then, it's become a cult classic, beloved by generations of kids, thanks to the innovative designs and, of course, David's unforgettable performance and unforgettable hair. So with this in mind, I'd like to welcome you to the start of Labyrinth Week, a celebration of this oft-overlooked Bowie treasure. Over the next few days, I'll share interviews with several people who helped bring Labyrinth to life. And today, we're starting with the perfect person, conceptual designer Brian Froud, the man who imagined the world of Labyrinth. Brian is a legendary illustrator and painter who works in the realm commonly referred to as fantasy, though as you'll see, he personally objects to the word. His paintings breathe life into ancient folklore and oral history, depicting the spiritual side of the natural world through fairies and mythological figures. The rich imagery attracted the attention of Jim Henson, and in 1977 they began work on a different cinematic saga, The Dark Crystal. The film took them 5 years to complete and left them both exhausted. As soon as it was done, they dove headlong into Labyrinth. It began with Brian's drawings of goblins and monsters and surreal landscapes. His visions formed the basis for the film's script, written by Monty Python veteran Terry Jones. Brian helped oversee the construction of elaborate character puppets, another multi-year process. The production was something of a family affair. Also at the workshop was his wife, Wendy, a legendary sculptor and puppet maker, perhaps best known for fabricating Yoda for the Star Wars series. And they were also joined on the set by their son, Toby, as in Baby Toby, abducted by Jareth, the Goblin King. Brian put his heart, soul, imagination, and firstborn into this film, so it seemed only right that we kick off Labyrinth Week with him. I hope you enjoy our conversation. To start, there was a wonderful quote you gave where you said, "Everything you need to know is in a tree." And that seemed like a great place to start. I wanted to ask you more about that and the role that nature plays in your work. It all seems to sort of flow from there.
Yes. I remember when I was working in England and I was creating my paintings, which were, well, I guess sort of organic. And I was really inspired by an artist called Arthur Rackham, who worked at the turn of the century and illustrated some definitive books of the Grimm brothers and Wagner, you know, the Ring cycle and various things like that. And the thing that inspired me the most was that his trees were always twisted and strange and full of life, and they would have faces in it. And then the creatures he would draw were like a tree, like the branches, you know, that they were, that the lines were very flowing. I was working in London at the time, but I wanted to move to the country because I wanted to develop my art. I knew I needed to move to the countryside, which I did, and was immediately struck by what I was looking at, which were rocks and trees and hills. And I felt as an artist, I could see what they looked like on the outside, but I was always intrigued about what they looked like on the inside. Mm. And as I articulated that, I started to draw more and more gnomes and fairies, which got classified as fantasy art, which I always get a bit annoyed at. I mean, I'd say, I don't do fantasy, I do reality. This is the real spiritual nature of the world. When I first came to America, I was a guest of honor at the World Fantasy Convention. I was convinced there wasn't a single tree in America because that, you know, inspirational energy was not showing up in the arts, you know, in the fantasy art. And I was both shocked and delighted to discover that America has wonderful trees. I mean, the most amazing trees. And then I was a bit annoyed at the artists. I said, why aren't they looking at your own trees? They were too busy looking at each other's work.
It's very American.
Yeah, rather than being inspired with something that was right on their doorstep. So there's something about branches and the flow of a branch, the fact that it's organic, is the way I like to draw. You know, that a line needs to be expressive, and it has to be expressive of whatever it is, the character or soul or something like that. But it's always going to be sort of different each time, but it's rather precise. So, you know, there's no one way of drawing. What I try to draw is spirit, really. I mean, I try to draw the invisible, which is, I don't know why enough I got down that route of trying to draw fairies.
I have a family member who is deeply involved in spiritual work, and I told her I was speaking to you, and she was so thrilled. And I found myself asking her this question, and I'd like to ask you now, what is a fairy? Because it does seem to encompass a fairly wide swath of characters, but are they psychic impressions? Are they creatures? How would you define a fairy?
Tough questions first, eh?
I'm sorry.
I think that's a fascinating, it's a fascinating thing. You know, because everybody wants proof, or they want evidence, and they want it to be real. And then if you say, well, you see it in your head, they go, see, it doesn't exist, does it? But it does seem to me that fairies or spirits are often spirits of place. They're a spirit of a hill or a specific location. And that's why I think when they show up and when you see them, or people's experience of them, are often very similar. The shapes and forms are responding to the energy of a place. And so it is the spirit of that place. And when they sort of show up, I'm doing the inverted commas with my fingers here, is that it seems to me it's simultaneously like in your head, but also projected seemingly outside. Certainly, I don't see fairies very often, but if I do, you absolutely know you've seen it, but it's not going to be necessarily very clear, if it makes any sense. I mean, I remember being on tour in America, and I was somewhere, I don't remember exactly where I was, but somewhere on the West Coast, and I was walking around, and I was thinking, I don't know. I just feel to be experiencing, about that's the best way of saying it rather than seeing, but experiencing leprechauns. And I thought, hello, I'm going a bit doolally here. Why am I thinking about leprechauns? And then I suddenly saw a sign, and it said, on this site were fever sheds. And it was when ships were coming in, and there were a lot of Irish immigrants coming in, and they had fevers. They put them in isolation in these sheds. And I thought, gosh, I think they brought leprechauns with them.
Wow.
I think they're spontaneous visual expressions of, you know, of energy, of spiritual energy, I suppose. Yeah.
Did you feel that you saw things differently, or saw things that most people don't see from an early age? Or I guess the question is, did you choose fairies, or did they choose you?
I think they absolutely chose me. I can't say that I saw them, but it was my first glimpse of Arthur Rackham's art when I was at art school. And I was training to be a painter, and I was getting really bored with it. I just thought, you could paint a rubbish picture, but if you could explain it in grand words, it was called, you know, good art. And I thought, this is absolutely, you know, patently not true. I mean, I really sort of believed that a picture should be self-evident and it should tell its own story. So I thought I'd change courses and go and study graphic design, because graphic design seemed to be much more direct with an image having a meaning, and you could understand it. And as I was waiting for my interview in the library, I came across Arthur Rackham's book, Midsummer Night's Dream. And in it were you know, these pictures, wonderful pictures of, in the scratchy ink lines, trees with faces in it. And I thought, ah, I didn't see it that way when I was young, but that's how I felt when I was climbing up trees. I felt there was the spirit of it. And that's how I got drawn in to wanting to draw fairies. And as I, when I went on the course, graphic design course, it was really boring. I really found it really boring. And so I sort of trained myself to illustrate. You know, I got very interested in Grimm's fairy tales and did my own drawings. And as I was drawing fairy tales, I became more and more interested in the possible psychic reality of real fairies, and started to also try and paint beings sort of made of light and that were elusive and they weren't difficult to, were really impossible to paint. I don't know what I was thinking of that. And I've always wanted my pictures, you know, from then on to somehow incorporate some sense of spirit.
Something that you do so well that is so incredible to me is that there is such a sense of realism in your work, and that makes it so much more evocative. What is key to getting through to people in that way and to putting that sense of realism? Is there something that really is integral you have to nail just right in order to make it have that sense of realism?
I think it's the desire to allow people to believe. And so, say one of my paintings that can be very complex, there's always what I would call a touchstone. And so that would be something that was really realistic, something that people would know, understand. It might be a human figure. And that allows the viewer to trust me as the artist. Because when I start to take them on the journey, and when I start to go down the deep end, and things have become stranger and stranger, then they are believing that as well. So I have over the years painted very abstract paintings of just pure light. And I could just do that, but I think there would be, unfortunately, a possibility people would just dismiss it as being, you know, madness. And what I wanted to do is to bring people on a journey to there. And so my complex paintings, they are more akin to maps. And so these maps allow you to go on the journey into fairyland. They are take you in safely, but in folklore, going into fairy is quite dangerous. You can get lost, you can get trapped, you can be in there for years and come back and you find time has changed, or everybody you knew has died. It's a very dangerous place to be. You can lapse into madness. So you need a safe way out. And so my paintings are hopefully precisely that. They're maps into fairy.
It's so funny to me how these days fairy work is sort of placed in the realm of you know, a children's nursery or something like that. Whereas, as you said, historically, through the ages and with oral histories, it is a very dark, very adult, very sort of dangerous place.
Yes, it seems to me when I started, fairy was definitely still relegated to the nursery. It was, you know, it's thought to be a childish occupation, whereas precisely it was part of everybody's lives, because you needed to placate the fairies. You had to leave like little gifts or, you know, saucers of milk or presents for them. Otherwise, they stole your children, took them away, or they turned them into changelings and they sickened and died. Your cattle died. You could die because, you know, you had a stroke and that was elf shots. You know, there would be these magical, invisible elf shots that cause heart attacks. So you had to have a proper relationship with the spiritual beings that surrounded you in the world. The fairies weren't, you know, pretty little things, you know, in little pink dresses and glittery wings. They were dangerous and strange creatures. So I've been trying to re-engage with that aspect of it for years.
You mentioned fairies sort of abducting children. That leads us right into really the plot of Labyrinth. I guess just to begin there, how did you first cross paths with Jim Henson?
I had moved down to the country on the edge of Dartmoor, and I'd been painting pictures for book covers and sort of for books. And I really wanted to paint more, you know, fairy creatures and trolls and that sort of thing. And I really wanted to paint pictures that didn't have a strange blank bit at the top where you put in the title of the book. I wanted to fill in all the space with stuff. And I had some work in a couple of major books about illustration at the time, and I was on the front of one of them. And actually, Alan Lee, who worked with me on the fairy book, but also won the Oscar for his wonderful designs for Lord of the Rings. And he was on the back. And actually, it was the first picture I painted when I moved to the country. And it was of a troll with a waterfall coming off the end of its nose. And there was a rainbow. And Jim Henson saw that one. And he was, back of his mind, he was thinking about doing a major film using puppets. And he thought, well, maybe this chap might be the person to do it. So they got in contact with me, and I went to see Jim. And he said, well, what do you think? I was sort of terrified. I don't know. I mean, I just really thought that puppets had such a potential to be expressive and to be expressive of a strange world and a deep world that could tell a story. And so he said, well, you know, come to New York. And I went to New York, and we started on it there. But Jim didn't know at the time that I could do sculpts. I was sculpting little things. And so I was in at the deep end because I didn't know quite how to tell people what to do. And so I actually made things a lot just to explain to them what I was thinking. And that was 5 years of my life. Every day I was working on the Dark Crystal. When we'd finished that, there was a showing of the film in San Francisco. I was there with my wife, Wendy, and Jim, and we were driving away from that in a limousine. And we, you know, say 5 years of our lives, we were just exhausted. And I thought, well, never, that's it. I've had enough of all this stuff. And Jim said, oh, should we do another one? And we said, oh, well, why not?
This was in the back of the limo.
Yeah, and so he said, well, what was it going to be about? And I said, I don't know. And he said his daughter, Lisa, who was majoring in mythology, you know, been talking to him. And he said, well, maybe it should be about Indian mythology, because there's all sorts of, you know, strange chariots and horses and gods going across the sky. And he said, well, do you know anything about that? And I said, no, I haven't the faintest idea. And so he sort of thought of a bit more, and I said, well, you know, I know about goblins. Oh, he said, no, that sounds interesting. And I said, well, the goblins traditionally steal babies, because what Jim had said this time, he said, I just don't want puppets. I want to put some human beings in it. And I just had this vision of a baby surrounded by puppets, these strange, gnarly goblin puppets. And I thought that will really work. And so Jim was on board with that. And he said, well, what else? And so out of desperation, I sort of said, well, what about a labyrinth? I said, thinking that a labyrinth is not only a place that you can wander around in, it's also a metaphor for life's journey. And that's where we left it. We said, that's great. And I came back to England and I started to paint various pictures. First of all, it was the baby with the goblins around it. And then I did other things of possible creatures that we would might meet in the labyrinth. And then we started to develop the story to go with it.
What was your working relationship like with Terry Jones, who worked on the script? Were there meetings between you two, or did he purely go off your series of images?
Labyrinth was about 3 years to do. And we were doing that in England because Jim was working on The Muppet Show, which they were recording here in England at Elstree. That way he could be doing that and keeping an eye on us in the workshop as we were starting to build and make these characters and develop the story. And we were getting fairly close to film. And Jim said, I don't know, I think it needs tweaking, the script. So he, like I was a Python fan, and we knew that Terry Jones was a historian as well, that, you know, his sense of history and visual stuff was great. So Jim said, I think I'll ask him just tweak it. So he came in to the workshop and just looked around, and I had on my desk my sketchbooks, and he started just to look through the sketchbooks, and he kept going, oh, that's great, oh, I love that. And he just picked out some things that were, you know, like the wild things or knockers and various things. And he went away, and instead of just tweaking and then like shining up the script, he just wrote a whole lot of new stuff. And we had a whole lot of new characters suddenly. And luckily, we were now a well-trained team about making things. And so it didn't faze us. We just sort of started to build the new characters for it. And then what Terry had spotted is really, because I'm English, that a lot of my references for the characters I was drawing really was Alice in Wonderland. And he sort of drew some of that aspect out of that with the new characters. Jim loved all that, but he hadn't really spotted how part of like my DNA, I suppose, of my Englishness, was in the drawings, and Terry Jones had. And Terry Jones was an absolute delight to work with.
It's funny you mentioned that. I think of the guards, with each have the two heads. And it's a very, you're right, Alice in Wonderland. I love the sort of the logic humor of that, the very Lewis Carroll, like just wordplay that completely plays off the incredible visuals.
Right. Well, the design of those characters came from what can I do as a designer to design what puppets do the best? Because puppets don't really do a lot, but you've got to imply they do a lot. And you've got to give them some really good stuff to do so you believe they can do a lot more. And so one of the basic things of a puppet is just popping up the top of the playboard, you know, that horizontal line, and they stick their heads over the top. And I thought, well, you know, that's what it is. I'll just make this oblong and we'll just have a head. And I thought, well, that's not enough. And then I suddenly thought about playing cards, and playing cards have heads at the top and the card has heads at the bottom, because you can use the cards any way you lay them down, any way around. So suddenly I thought, we've got a character here, and it's going to be relatively easy to make. It's going to be strange, but it was. Then it suddenly became a reference to the cards in Alice in Wonderland. And then Terry wrote all this, you know, very funny dialogue for them, and that brought them to life.
Was it a struggle translating your illustrations into three dimension? I mean, there must have been a lot of trial and error for not only developing something in the three dimension, but also something that would then be manipulated to give performances. I mean, something like Ludo.
Well, all that stuff, yes. That was why it's like 5 years for Dark Crystal and three for Labyrinth, is that I couldn't just do the designs and walk away. My designs can be fairly loose because it's no good pinning it down too soon. You have to go through those stages of finding out how you're going to bring it to life and how you're going to mechanically make that happen. And so there often is quite a lot of prototype work where you just like cobble something together to start with, and you find out what your problems are. And now I'm redesigning as that's happening. I'm trying to build on the strengths of how things are made. So it's only really near the end when we've done the sculpt and we're putting it together. You can still be making changes, and I'm still coming to the final conclusion of what the color's exactly going to be like, what's the finish going to be like, because it's part of my job is to guide that. Is to keep the spirit of that going, because it needs to show up at the end. It needs to show up on the screen and be alive. And that is teamwork. That's a lot of people with all their skills bringing it together. And it's, you've got, a huge amount of people working on things. And part of what I need to do is corral that, is to make it, keep it going in the right direction, because rather than it spinning off out of control and it feels like it's the wrong thing. Something like Ludo is one of the Henson's triumphs, is they were used to building big creatures, and when we were building that, they had the expertise to do it, but Jim would come in and look at it, and all his comments were not about the way it was looking, but how does it feel for the performers? How can we make the person on the inside and the other people helping move it, how can we make their life easier, that we don't hurt them, we don't damage them, and also how that they can be more expressive to the character? So, we spent a long time building or rebuilding until we finally got to the end result. And when you saw like all the things that we built, when they came to life, just in the studio, before we even got them on the set, it would just take your breath away, because there was magic happening in front of your eyes.
It must have been emotional to see this character that existed only in your imagination suddenly be, as you said, alive in front of you.
Yes. Yeah, and I know that it had been a long journey for Jim, because I know he got excited about the possibility of what you could do with puppets. And I know one of the first things Jim got me to see when I was first went to America, he did these characters on Saturday Night Live.
That's right.
And he said the thing that made them different, they had glass eyes in it. And so, and there's these little glittery eyes, and it just gives them this uncanny look. And that was sort of the beginning of everything. And so you can see that journey from those puppets to Labyrinth, when you've got Ludo or you've got the goblins, and we worked hard on getting all the eyes for everything right. Jim believed in the potential of, the potential of telling a story with deep emotion. And it was quite extraordinary, because we knew that with the Muppet Show that people and puppets interact seamlessly. That was the Muppet Show with guests on. And so we knew we had no problem with having Jennifer Connelly, the girl, or a baby, or David Bowie, interacting with inanimate objects made out of rubber and fur and bits and pieces that you would just absolutely believe it.
I know you must love all your children equally, but is there a puppet or a character that really stands out as a above the others as a personal favorite for you from that film?
Oh, Lord.
So many, I'm sure.
There are so many of them. The milk bottles. No, it wasn't even me that doing that. I mean, that was. It was really interesting to be, you know, filming in England with an English crew. You know, there are the gates to the Goblin City, and some of the English crew had just put two little milk bottles down by the step. And that's very English, you know, because in the days that milkmen delivered milk to your door, we just put in that, you know. But Jim was always, he loved all those little details, and we always put all sorts of little details in. Jim always had a thing about chickens, I think he said. I remember him saying, oh, we're going to put some chickens in. So we got this, so they hired this chicken wrangler to come in with the chickens. But then on that night, he sort of said to us, he said, you know, he might be a wrangler. But he said, but chickens do nothing. They said, you can't wrangle a chicken. But it's all those things that you need on a set to to bring everything to life. And chickens do help, I think. Or maybe they distract. I don't know.
I mean, what's the old expression? Don't work with kids or animals. And Jim did both.
Well, exactly. No, it's precisely that. Yeah, yeah.
Speaking of kids, Toby is your son. Whose idea was it to cast your son as the baby in the film?
Well, we obviously always needed a baby at some point. And then I said the first picture I painted was of a baby surrounded by goblins. By the time we were ready to film, we suddenly realized we needed a baby. And lo and behold, I seemed to have one of my own who was actually precisely the right age. And so it seemed the easiest thing to do was to hire Toby, who actually looked remarkably like my painting.
Wow.
The baby in the painting, which is quite extraordinary. And also the fact that, because he was ours, he was just really used to being surrounded by strange, you know, creatures.
I never thought
of
that.
Which he loved. Yeah, I mean, there are some moments that you see in the film where he's crying, which is unfortunate. And it was never because he was frightened of the goblins at all. It's just that they would start the playback, the music, really loud. And we kept saying, can you just turn it down? Could you just, like, just tweak it slightly? But they would just rather startle him when David Bowie would start singing.
How was David with Toby? It must have been surreal, not only just to see David Bowie with a child, but have it be your son. What was there? I hesitate to call the relationship, but how was David with Toby?
Well, but I was really never there because I was always in the workshop, and the workshop was in Hampstead in London, and we were filming out at Elstree. Because I was just always too busy, because we're always trying to get, you know, the next puppets ready or the next scene, or I'd be on the next set to, like, check on all that. But it meant that my wife, Wendy, who's the baby's mother, was there, you know, all the time. David was great. I mean, he was a really, really lovely, lovely man. So it was easy. I mean, Wendy was always there to make sure that Toby was safe. The interesting thing is that once we knew that we were going to have a live baby, I also knew that we would need probably a puppet baby. We'd need something, some other things. And that's when I designed the stripy outfit for the baby, that it needed to be really distinctive, that you could see it from a distance. And you would be able to see the baby wherever it was in the general mayhem of the sets and the goblins. And also, like, the stripes did refer to Alice in Wonderland, to, you know, her stockings, that sort of thing. And also the fact that we could duplicate, we'd had a puppet, which we didn't really, but we had, like, a fake baby that David could throw up in the air. It's always a shock when I see the film and I go, oh, that's my baby up in the air, but it's not. It's just... And I know Toby, you know, over the years have gone to various, like, conventions and things that they have, like Labyrinth conventions, where they do throw a stuffed baby around, which he finds a bit shocking.
Do you recall meeting David for the first time? What were your first impressions of him?
Yes, I do. I mean, it was very interesting times because he had an assistant who was very protective of him. And so she didn't really like too many people getting anywhere near him, which was unfortunate. You know, but he himself was just absolute delight. And so we were just a few days away from him starting. And we were still trying to sort out, like, his wig and various things. And I remember having a meeting with him in his dressing room, which had nothing in it yet because he just really arrived. And we had made for him, as a gift, a little bone flute, little tiny thing, and it played. So it's a very ancient thing, and I know the sound of it is a very ancient sound. And we gave it to him in his dressing room, and he just took it, and he just did the most extraordinary thing. He leapt up onto the tabletop, you know, with the mirror behind it, with all the lights around it, and he hunkered down and he played a tune on it, and it was the most spooky thing. It was like he was Puck. Or some, he was definitely very fairy-like. And what you really wanted to do was, like, go to the corner of the room, get away, because it was just so powerful and so exhilarating. And he just sort of got the spirit of the Goblin King. It's a shame that there was nowhere, you know, in the characterization in the film that, to have anything like that. But he was quite extraordinary. Another thing about him is that he was very funny. You know, he was very lighthearted and connective. But so my dealings with him were at a distance. You know, I'd be making costumes and things in the workshop, and you know, the things were taken to him, and he'd be wearing it. But I never really. My wife Wendy would saw him like every day when dealing with Toby, but I never really saw him again after that.
Wow, that is quite an impression. That is unbelievable. I mean, it seems like, well, once is enough, it seems like, from that. Just the energy coming off of him, as you said, sounds extraordinary.
Yes.
Wow. How did the style of Jareth evolve from, you know, his costume and his hair and everything and his makeup? How involved were you with developing that, his look?
Actually, some of the designs for him hardly exist at all. I mean, there is a funny sketchy bit that really became his major look, and it's about maybe 2 inches tall in a sketchbook. I mean, it was just sort of scribbles, but we were developing it, and I did lots of designs for that, because what he is as a character is really figments and fragments of a teenage girl's imagination. And so first one, which Jim really wanted, was pop star, you know, somebody that would bring to the part all those things, you know, a famous person would naturally have. Bowie was absolutely perfect because in his characterizations, you know, on stage are various, you know, incarnations of different characters. You know, Ziggy Stardust, he's all sorts of different people. That's the way he is as a creative artist. So he brought that to it, you know, because I did have some costumes where maybe he'd be in a suit or whatever. I always saw the Goblin King as somebody mercurial and changing. And so the next thing was that I felt that he came out of sort of literature, so sort of romantic literary figures.
Lord Byron.
So there's very much Heathcliff from Wuthering Heights in there. There's Rochester from Jane Eyre, and Mr. Darcy from Pride and Prejudice, as well as, you know, things like Mephistopheles, which is, it's all very theatrical, which absolutely David understood. My design for the wig was a couple of little scribbles, you know, didn't know quite what it was. And we started to pursue it, and we thought, well, maybe it should be like a wolf, you know, that we would start to go down the route that he could have some sort of wolf-like characteristics. But it just made him sort of look old and grey. Once we got the general shape of the wing, David just sort of took charge, basically, because this is his territory. You know what I mean? He's used to the glam rock. You know, it's meant to be this sort of glam rock look. You know, and the fact that it's like a Tina Turner look as well, he totally got. You know, so we meant we could just like tweak it a bit and make it more raggedy and all that. You know, he got his own person to do the strange makeup, you know, eye stuff, and he literally could step into it. And so when we were then developing, you know, other aspects, which was the sort of the leather jacket look, because that is also, I wanted that sort of dangerous, you know, the wild one, young Marlon Brando look. But we also wanted it to be very much part of the goblin world where, so that also relates to, there's some mercenary soldiers in the 1500s, the Landschnecks, who were quite flamboyant. So some of that costuming refers to that. So the tight pants and the boots and this leather jacket that all has bits of armor on it, but the armor is all tweaked. We got, you know, strange worms boring their way through the armor, which is sort of comes from like tombs of death. I really want it to be really a rich amalgam of influences that would turn up in the costumes. We were finishing the film and we were coming to the last scene with David, and it was at the end of the film. And we were sort of relaxing a bit. We think we can go home soon, basically. And we suddenly realized, oh, well, shouldn't he have another costume at this stage? And we went, oh, maybe he should. And we sort of actually stayed up all night and sort of built that thing for him, which is rather kabuki, Japanese kabuki look. You know, because I wanted him to be like a ghost. So I was thinking of the kabuki theater, ghosts are really strange things. And so we sort of quickly built it with a sort of wispy fur and the bone collar and everything.
How familiar were you with his music? I know kabuki was a big influence on his own style in the Ziggy and Aladdin Sane years. How deeply were you aware of his musical work?
Well, I've always been a fan, and I have liked it. And I know that he was very interested in when he trained in mime, and it shows up in all the costumes. And I knew that he would respond to it. The unfortunate thing was that not actually really being able to talk to him about it, because everybody, my infamous, perv pants, as they're called, these really tight trousers, were there for a reason. I mean, because partly also, not only it's part of that look of that Heathcliff and all that, that period where the trousers were fairly tight and the boots, you know, and the tailcoats and all that, we were going for that, but also a ballet dancer. I mean, it really is, that would be another influence to all that. But what I really wanted to give him was a big metal codpiece, which I hadn't quite got round to design, and I didn't know quite how to tell anybody this is really what I wanted to do, but in the end I didn't get the chance. I'm sure he would have worn it. He seemed quite happy to, go with this sort of expressive theatrical look.
I mean, it seems so wonderful that he was so willing to have a sense of humor about himself and to really commit so deeply to something like this. You know what I mean? Like, it seems like really wonderful that he seems so willing to play, I guess is the best way I can think to put it, to be so willing to try new things, which I guess shows up in his own musical work anyway.
Yeah. Well, also, what I wanted to do was actually, that's an interesting thing about the idea to play, because that just reminds me of something, is that I designed for him, which is that swagger stick, that little whip thing, which has the crystal ball on the end. But I thought, if I give him that, it also gives him, as a performer, something he understands, which is a microphone, you know, something to hold in his hand. And it worked, you know. It helped him, I think, enormously when he was performing with all the goblins to have that in his hand. It refers to the whole gamut of theatrical expressions of romantic literature. That's what we were trying to do. And he was great at it. I mean, there was one odd thing happened. We were also building more costumes for him, and we worked one weekend with lots of them, and they were presented to him, and he would turn them down. Actually, there was only one he turned down, which was a big robe thing. But suddenly, in the newspapers, it says Bowie rejects costumes.
Oh, no.
And we thought, what's that about? It was very odd. And we thought, that doesn't make any sense. You know, this is just us making a movie here. And then I realized what was going on, because making the film was part of a sort of a comeback. He had been out of the public eye for a while, and this was publicity. He had leaked the story himself because what he was doing, actually probably that very weekend, I think it was, when we were working on the costume, he was actually out on the streets filming with Mick Jagger. And they had this, I forgot the name of the song now, but they had a hit song.
Well, Dancing in the Streets, for Live Aid.
Yeah, yeah. So that's what he was up to. And so it was a very clever move. But all the other costumes, and he was so happy to wear. So
I wanted to ask you, and this is probably a strange question, did you have any keepsakes from the set? Like, I think I read that you got a mystic coat from the set of the Dark Crystal. The costumes made me think of it. Do you have anything from Labyrinth?
I've got something. It was so a few years ago, I was going to a convention, and I had what I had in my case, and it went through the scanner, and a supervisor said, "This over there," and it went over there, and I had this lady who started going through the bag, and she couldn't find anything, and she said, "Can't find," "It's in there, look," and she said, "I can't find, what do you think you got?" And I said, "I don't know." I said, "Oh," I'm thinking, "Oh, metal probably set it off." Because the supervisor kept saying, is he a public notary? I'm going, a dangerous public notary? I mean, was it? And when I fished it out, I have David Bowie's necklace. You know, it's this claw-like thing we designed for him. And I that was what it was. And that was, the scanner was picking it up. And she looked at it, and she said, and when she was really, so this is cool. I said, it's David Bowie. He said, wow. And I said, why do you think it's public notary? And she said, oh, he thinks it's one of those, you know, where they sort of have the lever and they stamp, you know, that seal on it. And he said, he doesn't know that they make a plastic nowadays. It wouldn't be metal. Well, that was really all I got.
Wow, that's really special. I mean, you know, you speak of going to these conventions. What is it about the film that makes it held so dear by so many? What do you think it is that resonates after all these years?
Well, I mean, to be honest, I think we were slightly disappointed when we finished. I mean, this sounds bad, but it is. But there was a purity to Dark Crystal because it was all puppets. And then we thought, well, I don't know. We've got people in it. Are we retreating somewhere to have people in it? And, you know, it seems a bit lighter and everything. But we were missing it. What we missed, and that's what the power of it is, that the story speaks to generations of generations of young girls. And they keep coming through, you know, we keep getting new ones of them. And so somehow it relates to their predicament, to their way they are. Because that was the idea, that, you know, she's just going through that stage in her life where she's having to leave behind the young girl aspects of herself and start to become a woman. That's what it was about. And I think we'd completely missed that aspect of it. And when you see it again, you go, oh, yes, now I get it. I don't know. But it absolutely, people do love it. And it rises in people's hearts more and more. So, yeah.
Has your relationship to the film changed at all? Like, do you recognize the person who created those characters?
Sometimes it's hard to do that. I mean, I know that Dark Crystal, for years, took a long time before I could disassociate the music from emotions.
Mm.
Because in the film, the music is about the emotions of the story, but working on it, all you remember with the music brings back to you is how, you know, dirty and dusty and tiring it is on set, how stressful it is to try and get the things made on time, get them right, all those sort of things. You know, so some of that aspect happens in Labyrinth, but I think it helps enormously to have lyrical songs in it, to have Bowie's voice helping tell the story as well. But it is a story that people do respond to. I mean, I know we had a royal premiere for it, and it was Prince Charles and Diana came to that one. And I remember years later, I met Prince Charles, and it was the opening of the Museum of Moving Image in London. And I met him, and I'd been invited along to hear him like open it, and then they said, quick, go around the back, he's going to go around. So I went around the back, and he's coming around, and he came past the Henson lot, and he was asking them, you know, what do they do? And they were all like secretaries. And he got to me and said, well, what do you do? And I said, well, nothing. I said, they fired me. He said, oh. And I said, well, actually, sir, you know, we have met. We met the opening of Labyrinth. And he said, oh, Labyrinth, yes. Oh, very, very good film. Very funny. He said, yeah, the bog of eternal stench. Because all that sort of farting noises. And he said, yes. He said, I was laughing. He said, in fact, I was the only one laughing. Because everybody was very embarrassed about all that. But he loved it. I mean, he just, you know, he talked knowledgeably about it. And he's a great fan.
Oh, he loved all the Goons stuff and Peter Sellers.
Yeah, exactly.
And, yeah.
I think it's that lineage, you know. And so I think via the Pythons and Terry Jones as well. So I think he related to all that.
How about Toby? How does he feel about it these days?
Oh, I mean, I think he's absolutely delighted to have been, you know, part of it. I mean, obviously he doesn't remember too much about, you know, what it was like to be on set, because he was only a year in the bit, you know. But it's given being part of our family and being part of the making of things like, you know, the puppets and the goblins, that's in his blood now. You know, that's what he loves to do, you know, filmmaking and creatures.
And he was involved in the Dark Crystal series on Netflix that from a few years back.
He was, yeah, supervising. Yeah, he was great. I mean, because it's a great to work with him. We make a great team. You know, I have no patience, and he's very patient. He said, well, what my father meant to say then was, you know, it keeps me calm. And he's, and you know, he finds solutions to things, because it's, everything is about trying to figure things, you know, how to do things together. I mean, the best times of working on the new series was, well, I mean, there was one time where we were building all these knives and swords and things that are growing out the back of the Skeksis. And we were working on it. It was about half past 8 at night. And I said to Toby, this is a big, you know, film series, isn't it? He said, yes. I said, yeah, this is Netflix. This is big, isn't it? He said, yes. I said, well, how come it's only you and me working on it? Sometimes you just got to do it yourself, you know, literally. And then, you know, in the morning, you're trying to get something on set. And we were there, whatever, you know, 6 in the morning, on our hands and knees, literally on our hands and knees in front of the costume, gluing things to it, you know, and aging it so it could be on set at 9. And that was just, was actually fun, you know, to be with my own son, hands on, getting your hands dirty, and indeed often bleeding on it. I mean, I've said now the best costume is one you bled on, you know, because they often are quite, have strange, you know, sharp bits and various things and can be a bit dangerous. And I know I bled on a few of them, but that's part of the magic of these things, which are inanimate, you know, that's made out of stuff, but you try to imbue them with spirit. And so it's great to be working on things that are three-dimensional, because they're like me working on one of my paintings, which I try to imbue with spirit. And if people can feel it's there, then the work is successful.
Your work has meant so much to me and so many of my loved ones. It's such an honor to speak to you. My last question, I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but my last question, what can we learn from fairies? What can they teach us?
Oh, that there are no rules. There are no rules in fairy, but what fairies do, they insist you do the right thing. So if you're in fairy stories, you've got to do the right thing. And in a dialogue with fairies, you've got to do the right thing, but they're not going to tell you what that is. And also, it keeps changing, so you've got to do it always the right thing at the right time. And that's tough. So it means it's a much, as a spiritual philosophy, it's tough, but I think it's much more open and caring and loving and connective.
Off the Record is a production of iHeartRadio. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe and leave us a review. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.